ஓம் நம சிவாய. டியர் லிசனர்ஸ் ஆஃப் சைவம் .org, தி நெக்ஸ்ட் ப்ரோக்ராம் இஸ் ஸ்பிரிச்சுவல் டிஸ்கோர்ஸ். இன் திஸ் யூ ஆர் அபவுட் டு லிசன் கவாய் ஹிந்து லெக்சர்ஸ். த டைட்டில்ஸ் ஆர் டேக் ஏ மொமெண்ட் டு லிசன் அண்ட் ஸ்வதர்மா, பிரசன்டட் பை ஸ்ரீ சிவாய போதிநாத வேலாயுத சுவாமி. Thank you. Om Namah Shivaya.
Consensualocracy. Hard to pronounce. Consensualocracy. So it's a wonderful principle that Gurudeva gives us. And it's the opposite of, well, not the opposite really, but it's different than how many matters are decided. For example, in politics, you're happy to have a majority, right? If something gets a majority, if more than 50% vote for something, it wins. So why do we use majority in politics? Because people have such diverse opinions, there's no way you can get everyone to agree. They just hold very divergent beliefs on basic facts of how life should be lived, about wealth, about government, and so you can't get everyone to agree. If you can get more than 50% to agree, you consider that the majority, and you do it that way. However, in religion, in a particular religion, members of that religion have the same beliefs, respect the same hierarchy, perform the same religious services. And so, having everyone agree is possible because they have common beliefs. So, in that context, Gurudeva defines consensualocracy, government or management by intelligent cooperation based on a shared vision and adherence to Dharma. Ahimsa, non-hurtfulness, is the keynote of this tribal family system of rule. Intelligent cooperation based on a shared vision. Wonderful statement. So, of course, our monastery works on this principle, and our family missions worldwide also follow it. But because so many activities we're involved in don't, I thought it would be helpful to share a few thoughts of how this type of management, consensualocracy, works best. So, usually you have meetings. Group gathers together and they have a meeting to discuss a topic. That's the basis for a decision. So, in the non-consensualocracy approach, you bring an idea, figure out your best idea, you bring it to the meeting, and you try and convince everyone of your idea. If you're successful at convincing everyone, you feel great. And if you're not successful, boy, they lost out on a great idea. Right? You feel that things are only right if everyone agrees with the idea that you brought to the meeting. That's not consensualocracy. Consensualocracy works best. You bring your best idea, but you're open to other ideas, and you're hoping that the group will get creative and develop an idea which is better than the idea that you brought, better than the idea that anyone brought. Because you're looking to create the best shared vision that you can. So it's a creative process. It's a detached process. You're not attached to your own idea. You're not trying to dominate and everybody agree with you. Rather, you're trying to create together by each one contributing their best thoughts in a free-flowing way and hoping to transcend what anyone would come up with individually. non-consensualocracy, you dominate the group with your viewpoint. Consensualocracy, you're helping others to express theirs. You're encouraging everyone present to express a viewpoint. So you don't dominate with a single idea. You want everyone to participate. So you're encouraging everyone there to share ideas. Another point to avoid is sometimes we'll get carried away in presenting our own viewpoint, and our words are so forceful they hurt people, or they're even disrespectful, and they hurt people in that way by not showing proper respect for everyone present and their opinions. So it works best when we always speak kindly and praise others' good ideas. So we want to be careful, as Gurudeva says, ahimsa, non-hurtfulness, is the keynote of this system of rule. So we can't hurt other people's feelings, either by being too forceful or not showing enough respect. So those are just some ideas on how we can all improve our consensualocracy management of our monastery and our missions worldwide. We recently participated in an event with Arun and Sananda Gandhi. They were here on the island, the grandson of Mahatma Gandhi, gave a lecture. And before that, there was a reception, so we went to the reception, and the mayor was there and other people we know. And listened to him and his wife talk. They gave his wife a chance to talk at the reception because he was, of course, talking at the lecture. So they wanted to hear from her as well. And she had some interesting ideas to express. And one of them, which she put forth right away, was that because the whole message of the evening was nonviolence, that she'd been married for 45 years, and though on many occasions she had given her husband good reason to be angry with her, he had never raised his voice once in 45 years. Never said an angry word in 45 years, either to her or to the children, even though she felt she deserved it on occasion. That was so sweet, the way she said it. And but it really showed a commitment to nonviolence, I thought, and on both of their parts, you know, that it wasn't just something in the political arena, you know, satyagraha, a way you motivate the British to leave India or something. It was something in their personal life that was a core belief. So that really impressed me. We didn't have a chance to stay for the talk, but we left at 7:30 and he still hadn't started talking. So about as late as we stay out. But it's going to be on Hoike television. Did we find out when yet? Yeah. In fact, they taped the interview with him on our property. So it'd be nice to listen to see what he says. We'll try and record it for the monks so we can all listen. We invited him to write for Hinduism Today some thoughts on the current violence in India. We hope he does and submits that. So I was impressed that they were living their ideal. That's what struck me. You know, it wasn't just a concept they were talking about, but in their personal lives they were living this ideal, which was the idea of this time. It's called a season of nonviolence. It's been going, I think, since 1998, Gandhi Institute and others have combined to have this activity in the United States, which is 64 days. It's between the birthdays of Martin Luther King and, is it the birthdays? No, it can't be the birthdays. Some day it honors Martin Luther King and Mahatma Gandhi, 64-day period. So every year for 64 days, starting it on the day that honors Martin Luther King, there's 64 days for nonviolence, and they have different activities throughout the country, including on Kauai, and one of the sponsors is the Unity Church. It's very active in this period. So we're hoping that a little more can be done on Kauai next year, and Barbara Curl is working with the Unity Minister on Kauai to get more activities related to it present on Kauai next year. It's that time of year on Kauai when it's warming up a little bit, and one of the changes is there's more bird singing. And why are we talking about bird singing? Well, because it's nice to stop and listen to the birds. They're so inspiring, so beautiful. And it's also a good check on our state of awareness. You know, are we, sometimes we're so wrapped up in our own thinking processes, our own emotions, that we don't perceive the beauties of nature. Don't stop and listen to the birds. In fact, there was some extra birds singing this morning. I guess they knew I was going to talk about birds, so they were chirping away during our meditation. But it's a wonderful practice to observe the beauties of nature, both just to enjoy it as well as to make sure we're stopping our mind from thinking and being absorbed in our concerns and our emotions and so forth. We had some beautiful clouds last night. I was out walking and enjoyed the clouds. Pong Swami tells me we've had some beautiful sunsets recently. I missed one. But we're so fortunate to be surrounded by so much beauty, and it's wonderful to stop and enjoy it as part of our life. One of the topics we're working on is karma management. As you know, principles for karma management. And the idea being that not just enough to understand all the intricacies of karma, be able to rattle off different kinds of karma, explain it clearly, we have to also apply it to our own life in order for it to really benefit us. So we're working on presentation, which has multi uses, one of which is it'll end up in Hinduism Today. That's always good. Hinduism Today appreciates whenever we can do something which ends up in Hinduism Today. And also, it's a good topic for lectures and it's a good topic for seminars, discussions together. So the introduction uses the analogy of the nutritionist. Says it's not enough to understand all the laws of nutrition and be able to get an A on any exam if in your own personal life you're eating junk food 3 times a day. You know, you haven't quite applied the knowledge yet where it should be applied, which is, of course, starting with yourself. So we worked out a new principle of karma management yesterday. It's called divinely influence karma. So how can we divinely influence karma? Well, through Lord Ganesha, of course. He's very useful in the realm of karma and dharma. So in reviewing what Gurudeva wrote on Lord Ganesha in various writings in our trilogy and the Lord Ganesha book, the idea is that, first of all, we need to establish a personal relationship with Lord Ganesha. So what does that mean? That means through worship, attending pujas to Lord Ganesha, doing pujas to Lord Ganesha, singing bhajans to Lord Ganesha, we appreciate his vibration, sense his vibration, go deeply into that vibration and develop a sense of closeness to Lord Ganesha. Feel that we know him. Feel that we know the vibration that he is. As Gurudev explains, Lord Ganesha resides upon the Muladhara chakra, chakra of memory. So, doesn't sound like a very high vibration, but lots of people aren't there. Sometimes we're probably not there. We fell below it. We went into fear. We went into doubt. Maybe we got a little bit angry. So Lord Ganesha helps us stabilize ourselves at a certain minimum state of consciousness. We don't fall into the lower states. Through getting to know Lord Ganesha, initially, of course all of us here are way beyond this, but when we're talking about initially, perhaps we have some adharmic habits, some practices that aren't virtuous that we're involved in. And getting to know Lord Ganesha, over time these practices will naturally drop away because we won't go into the states of consciousness where we could perform those actions. If you stay in a certain state of consciousness, you can't act another way that's below that state of consciousness. You have to fall into a state of consciousness that really gets angry in order to do certain things. If you never get angry, you can't do them anymore. So the reason the habits, adharmic habits, fall away is we don't end up in those states of consciousness anymore. We stay above them. Through the worship of Lord Ganesha, we have a stability in consciousness better than we had before. So what happens when we're not doing anything that's adharmic? We're dharmic, of course. We're following a virtuous life all the time. So Lord Ganesha helps us do that, but it doesn't stop there. It's not just dharma. It eventually leads to Swadharma. So Swadharma, Gurudev explains it so nicely, I'll read his explanation. Such a life is the fulfillment of all previous efforts and thus erases the uncomplimentary deeds and adds beneficial ones. So a next birth can be most rewardingly great and useful to the whole of mankind. That's a wonderful statement. Gurudev also describes Swadharma as our perfect pattern. Why is it perfect? Because it allows us to work out the karma we carry in the smoothest way and to make the most spiritual advancement. So it includes the occupation we choose, the various duties we perform in life to others. All of that relates to our Swadharma. So finding Swadharma is very beneficial in terms of spiritual progress because our karma then works out in a very smooth way compared to how it would if we were functioning in another pattern. In addition to Swadharma, Lord Ganesha helps us, divinely influences our karma as the Lord of Obstacles. As we know, the usual understanding of the Lord of Obstacles is, well, we want something, we pray to Ganesha, he removes the obstacle, and we get what we want. Of course, that's simplified. He's also the Lord of Obstacles in terms of placing obstacles in front of us so that though we want it, we may not get it because it's really not good for our dharmic pattern. It's taking us a direction that is not the most beneficial. So a simple way of understanding the Lord of Obstacles is to think of a mother with a young child. It's a constant juggle of obstacles. You have to take things out of the child's reach. You have to put things up to prevent the child from going places the child could fall down the stairs and so forth. So the mother is the Lord of obstacles when it comes to a young child. She's constantly moving them around so the child has fun when playing and doesn't hurt himself or herself. So Ganesha is like that to us in terms of the different kinds of actions we're performing. In some cases, he blocks them because we could harm ourselves. And in other cases, he removes obstacles so it's easier to be successful, all through his wisdom of being able to see past, present, and future. Because we can't see the past and the future, we only see the present. We don't have the same ability to choose our actions as wisely as he does. There are times when our life seems awfully complicated. We've got problems upon problems upon problems. Financial problems, employment problems, really seems to be getting worse instead of better. So, in times like that, the worship of Lord Ganesha can help us work our way out of these problems much more easily than we can on our own. But again, it's not automatic. We have to really worship Ganesha, feel close to him, bring him into our life, bring him into these problems, share these problems with him. Look at Ganesha and the devas that work with him as a partner. These aren't my problems, these are our problems. Together, we can sort this out and work through this much more easily, much more quickly than we can on our own. So being able to share our complicated situations with Ganesha, taking him and his devas as partners into our life, helps work out karma again through divine influence. So the bottom line is, we don't have to manage our karma totally on our own. We can have interplane help in the form of Lord Ganesha and his devas and work through many situations much more quickly and smoothly than simply on our own efforts. In reading through the Ganesha book, the parts on karma, fortunately we have indexes. We thank Kumar Swami and team for all these wonderful indexes which help you find all the quotes on karma in Ganesha so easily. I ran into a section on satsang group and karma. I was surprised. There's a whole section about satsang, and part of it talks about the satsang group and the management of karma. I said, oh, I forgot that that was there. So again, Gurudeva has a very powerful statement which summarizes the whole idea. Quote, I often say that the individual helps the group and the group helps the individual, unquote. So that's the idea of satsang. The individual helps the group, and the group helps the individual. So, wonderful example of that was recently at the time of Gurudeva's Prayopavesa, we had hundreds of devotees coming here from all over the world, and I think we all realized that having large numbers was helpful. It stabilized everyone. The grief was less. There was more joy than it would have been if one person was here. It somehow the group in that situation did just this. It helped. The individual helped the group, and the group helped the individual adjust to Gurudeva's Mahasamadhi. Well, why is that? Well, everyone in the group isn't moving in sync. The day that one person is sad and in grief, another person isn't. Another person isn't. So the person who's sad or having a difficult time is supported or made to feel better by those who are doing okay on that day. And then 2 days later, it all switches. This person who was happy is sad, and the one who is sad is happy and uplifted. And So everyone isn't in sync. We have different timings in terms of our karmas, our emotions, our distress, the difficult times in life, the joyous times in life. Fortunately, we don't all have the same karmic pattern, so we move differently. We respond differently. We're feeling very strong and spiritually uplifted when at a time when someone else is feeling discouraged and burdened. So our feeling strong at that time helps the other person from going as low as they would if we weren't associating with them. The other reason that, another reason that satsang works is that we tend to express the qualities we see in other people if they're within us. So if we spend all our free time with a group that's fairly worldly, if we have any worldly qualities in us, that will catalyze them to be expressed. We'll find ourselves acting in certain ways that we wouldn't if we didn't spend so much time with these people. So, in a positive sense, the religious tendencies we have are reinforced. We're more prone to express them when we spend time with people who have the same religious tendencies. So in that way, satsang helps us bring out the religious part of ourselves more readily, more easily. However, human nature is human nature, and even in satsang, we can see a downside if we let ourselves into that state of consciousness. For some reason, we seem to be built this way, that rather than find the faults in ourselves, we'd much rather find the faults in someone else. It's really strange. You know, don't know what good it does, but it's like, we know there's faults in us, but we don't really want to look at them. It's so much more fun, so much easier to see the faults in someone else than start to talk about them. Boy, this is fun. So it's human nature, and of course it's counter to religious life. It's distracting, and it can cause a negative vibration in a satsang group, or in our case, a church mission group, if we let ourselves get into that practice of one another talking about the faults or shortcomings of a third person. Maybe fun, but it's destructive in its own subtle way. It's a negative practice which hurts other people and certainly breaks down the strength of the religiousness of the group. So, of course, we need to take the Kaurals' guidance there, which advises us that it's so much easier to do this than to find the faults in ourselves, but we need to refrain from it. If we find ourselves critical of other people, turn that criticism on ourselves and say, gee, if I can see those faults in someone else, what faults can I see at this moment in myself? Not in the sense of trying to feel bad about ourselves, but in the sense of trying to improve ourselves. Everyone can improve, so the idea of finding faults is not to put someone down or put ourselves down, but to see the areas in which we can improve, even if they're very subtle. We can find them and make improvement, constantly refine our behavior, bring out more of our spiritual nature through taking this tendency to see the faults in others, putting up a mirror, seeing ourselves, see the fault in ourselves, and improve our own behavior